This is Real History with Melissa on the 27th day of August, 2026. I cannot believe it is going to be September next week. But the year is racing by. The good side of that equation is that there's only about a week and a half more of the triple digit days here. Super hot for those in the Celsius. It has been somewhere between 40 and 44 for about 32 days now, with another 10 or so to go. It's hot. I wanted to mention a few upcoming things that are possibilities for Real History or are scheduled. I think that next week I'm going to do a shorter installment of the getting to know some of the listeners. I had people that came in under the wire with things I was able to get on to the video last week, but I got a lot of interesting pictures and stories, so I think it'll be a much shorter episode, just kind of talking about some conversations that I've had even between then and now, which are interesting, and it is real history. I also will be talking to Neil Foster the second Thursday of the month. Nick Hayes and I are going to read and cover Rainbow's End. So I know I heard from a couple of you who read it way back when in the spring when we outlined what we were doing and what we were doing next, but we both had scheduling things and life, you know, life gets in the way. I read a book. There were a couple of listeners who were saying you really need to cover male circumcision of little babies, baby boys, infant male circumcision, or genital mutilation, as it's sometimes called. It's a topic that I thought, no, I don't want to go there, just because people are very divided on it. Some people think it's a really great thing and healthy, and other people don't. So I kind of investigated the landscape of who is talking and writing about that. I made contact with a woman named Georgianne Chapin, who founded Intact America. She was the founding executive director of that, and she is an intactivist. In the book that she recommended I read, that she wrote with another writer, entitled This Penis Business, she talked about who came up with the word intactivist or intactivism. It was not she that did that, but at the time that she started getting interested in it, other activists were working in the area, and someone said, what are we doing? We're keeping baby boys intact. We're intactivists. So Georgianne Chapin was a longtime healthcare executive. She has an interesting background, came of age at a certain point in the U.S. when there were a lot of things going on coming out of the Vietnam War, feminism, et cetera, et cetera. And I think I'm most interested in the question of whether or not this is a good thing. And having read the book and done a little investigation, I have my own thoughts on it, but I'll share the conversation with you when that gets set up. I'm hoping that happens in September, but it may be a little further out. There is also someone that I am beginning to communicate with. I think that I'm hoping to bring a conversation on her interesting work around Tavistock, mind control, some very interesting histories and personal history that she has uncovered, and other things I'm working on, but that's a few things for starters. But today, I had actually thought, no, I'm not going to put anything up this week because I'm busy on some projects, and I'll just focus on that. But over the weekend, I put up a redux of Alan Watt. And I wrote a piece that accompanied it, and it got me thinking about a real history that I did in September of 2024, which I entitled Mashup. And I had fun making the video for it. I used some music. I used clips of Alan Watt talking, and it focused primarily on euthanasia, but also on abortion. And I thought, I'll just replay that. I'll put that on the video channels, and I can make an audio for the website and the non-video channels, and that'll be that. But I realized that I would not be able to replay it for YouTube. And so I thought, well, for YouTube, I'll just read the article that I wrote last week, not sure, and put that up there and then direct them to other video sites. But as I was, as this thought was coming together in my head, I thought, why not just read that not sure piece, put it in front of Mashup, and that can be a real history. And so that is what I'm going to do. I posted this on the websites and on Substack on Sunday, the 23rd. And the title is, If the Goddess is Bloodthirsty, Is She Still Worthy of Worship? And there's just a couple of things I'll mention that as I go, there are pictures in it. And for those of you who see this in video form, you'll see the pictures. For those of you who are hearing it, you won't. So at certain points, I am going to let you know that what I'm reading to you is a link, and then I will describe the picture. It might be annoying for the video channel people, but it will help if you're just listening. I want to say at the top here, before I start reading this essay, this is not for children. It's not for younger people. So if you allow your children to listen along, then this is one that you would want to listen to first and decide if you think it's appropriate for them. If the goddess is bloodthirsty, is she still worthy of worship? A not sure piece to accompany Alan Watt Redux 277 Chronology on Parade. She sat down at the polished wood desk. Regency? Expensive. It was, after all, in the governor's mansion. On the desk was a glass dish filled with ornate blue and gold pens. We'll break for a moment. After all, we must be tired, 5 sentences in. Why are the pens blue and gold? Because the state flag is blue, gold, and white. There is a law that defines what the coat of arms of this commonwealth must contain. A blue shield with an Indian thereon, dressed in a shirt, leggings, and moccasins, holding in his right hand a bow, and in his left hand an arrow, point downward, all of gold, and in the upper right-hand corner of the field, a silver star of 5 points. The crest shall be on a wreath of gold and blue, a right arm bent at the elbow, clothed and ruffled, and grasping a broadsword, all of gold. The motto, Anse petit placidem sub libertat quietem, shall appear in gold on a blue ribbon. The governor took her chair, surrounded by adoring women dressed in hot pink. Each row of hot pink women was flanked with women in white lab coats. The doctors were so excited to be part of this event, they fled their hospitals, unscrubbed, still suited up from their important work. I'm a doctor, trust me. Behind this phalanx of dominatrices, I could spot the balding heads of a couple of men. Madam Governor took one of the blue and gold pens from the jar and opened the leather-embossed folder. A hush fell over the room, except for the news producer and cameraman who coaxed smiles and best sides of faces as M. Governor signed this historic bill, cheers erupted. From this cool and richly appointed room, the Praetorian Guard accompanied Madam Governor to the press room, where they were joined by other women, breathless, excited, aroused. She stepped to the microphone and said, "I stand with women. My opponents do not." She did not stand with a woman when first sworn into office. I don't know her relationship status when she was Massachusetts' first openly lesbian attorney general in 2014, but when elected governor, she was single. In 2022, she became one of the first openly lesbian women and the joint third openly LGBT person elected governor of a U.S. state, as well as the first woman elected governor of Massachusetts. In 2023, Governor Maura Healey, a practicing Catholic, entered a relationship with her former chief deputy, Joanna Lydgate. Healey stated that they did not begin their relationship until Chief Deputy Lydgate resigned her position. Lydgate has taken on the role of first partner of Massachusetts. There are lots of firsts for Madam Governor, but her law to remove all restrictions on abortion is not exactly one of them, since late term or third trimester termination of pregnancy exists in a few states. Most states that allow late term abortions place restrictions such as to save the mother's life or health. The language of Massachusetts law is clear: up to birth. Upon the historic signature, women across Massachusetts stopped what they were doing to celebrate. The motto of Massachusetts, Ense petit placidum sub libertate quietum, by the sword we seek peace, but peace only under liberty. There was not enough liberty for the women of this commonwealth, therefore there was no peace. Madam Governor is doing her best to supply a sword, the necessary tool for, quote, peacekeeping. What is the sword? First trimester, first 3 months, abortions are usually achieved with cervical dilation, a hose, cannula, and a suction device. Second trimester, months 4 through 6, termination calls for large, crushing forceps for crushing and dismembering, a spoon-shaped blade, curette, to scrape the uterine wall, and more suction. Third trimester, months 7, 8, and 9, abortions have many steps involved. Quote, fetal demise is achieved by needle or syringe with something like potassium chloride, which stops the heart. Then the cervix must be dilated, and the extraction procedure described in the second trimester is used. Sometimes labor must be induced. Live births following abortion attempts are not common, but they happen. This will become more common as more states relax restrictions. Those states that have used the overturning of Roe v. Wade to enact restrictions are well countered in their efforts by states like Massachusetts. Globally, 73 million abortions take place annually. Let that sink in. There is a picture of Madam Governor at her desk signing the bill, surrounded by women, many of them in hot pink and the ones in white lab coats. Years ago, the founder and CEO of Creative Artists Agency, Michael Ovitz, famously told his agents to concentrate on actors whose careers had a longer shelf life. Actresses have 3 to 5 years of high earning capacity, 10 if they're exceptional. Actresses are disposable, just like babies. I was disgusted by an article I read in the lifestyle section of a newspaper about an actress named Michelle Williams who discussed the abortion she had at the beginning of her career. Never heard of Michelle Williams? That's okay. Actresses are disposable, just like babies. At the 77th Golden Globe Awards in January 2020, Williams delivered an acceptance speech advocating for abortion rights and a woman's, quote, right to choose. Pregnant at the time of the awards ceremony, Williams stated she could not have achieved her career success without employing a woman's right to choose when to have my children and with whom, implying that controlling her reproductive timeline was essential to her life's work. In many eras of history, and especially since the 18th century concept of romantic marriage emerged, women have been able to decide when to have children and with whom. Cultural traditions like arranged marriages and terrible circumstances such as rape presenting exceptions. Michelle Williams now has 4 children, but I wondered when I read that article. Will her children be thankful their mom's career was already established when they were conceived? What will the 4 living children think about her public statement? There, but for the grace of a Golden Globe Award, go I, sucked out through a hose. A 2025 article in W Magazine is entitled, Michelle Williams is a Goddess of Sex in a Stunning Grecian Dress. A headline from 2023 in the Daily Mail reads, Michelle Williams looks like a goddess with white gown and sparkling sheer cape at 2023 Oscars. Goddesses have appeared in mythology since ancient times, with goddess worship accompanying. Artemis was the Greek goddess of the hunt, animals, nature, childbirth, and children. She was depicted surrounded by an entourage of nymphs. The etymology of her name has always been debated. Bear, pure, butcher. She loved children but demanded the human sacrifice of Iphigenia, daughter of King Agamemnon, who had offended her by killing a sacred stag and boasting he was the superior hunter. The Romans had the huntress Diana, whose protection of childbirth was never stained by human sacrifice. In Greek mythology, the Amazons were female warriors and hunters who lived in a closed society. They interacted with men long enough to breed and raised only females, so one wonders, what happened to the boys? Moloch was a Canaanite god portrayed as a bull-headed idol, hands stretched over the fire. He was associated with accounts of Carthaginian child sacrifice. Goddesses are not alone in their bloodthirstiness. In modern times, all things New Age and much that is neo-pagan springs from Madame Helena Blavatsky, who titillated and scandalized, depending on their sensibilities, her contemporaries with her lesbian affairs. Her writings, Isis Unveiled and The Secret Doctrine, introduced Western audiences to Eastern concepts like karma and reincarnation. Marija Gimbutas, in her archaeological work between the 1970s and the 1990s, popularized the goddess theory. According to Gimbutas, she who stands alone, because her ideas were not broadly accepted by mainstream archaeologists and prehistorians, Neolithic Old Europe was a peaceful, matricentric society worshiping a singular great goddess before being displaced by patriarchal Indo-European cultures. See? You just need the right expert to rewrite history. Others who contributed to the goddess rage include mythologists Robert Graves and Joseph Campbell, Gerald Gardner, the founder of Wicca in the 1940s and 1950s, and feminist Carol P. Christ, you cannot make this up, who articulated the feminist theological need for the goddess in her seminal 1978 essay, Why Women Need the Goddess. Speaking of P. Christ, the artist who submerged a crucifix in urine and called it Piss Christ, was a man, but working in the same era was performance artist Karen Finley, who inserted a yam in her vagina on stage and called it art. Yankee Doodle stuck a feather in his cap and called it macaroni. Anything's possible in art. In some of her performances, Finley allows herself to be, quote, possessed with other voices, including the goddess Kali, Hindu goddess of time, death, and destruction. In her piece, We Keep Our Victims Ready, something of Kali's nurturing face, Finley explores the dual aspects of the goddess, including birth and the cornucopian vagina. That's where the yam gets in. Girls just want to have fun. They enjoy the goddess aesthetic, crystals, candles, incense, flowing dresses, and pleasant stuff like that. A few take it seriously and dabble in white magic and spell work if they go the Wicca direction or embrace variations of the goddess movement, which sprang up in the 1960s. The divine feminine is venerated. The goddess can be interchangeable with Mother Earth. Nature is loved deeply to the point of worship. There are ethical discussions, feminist debates, theological debates. Is the goddess one or many? Monotheism versus polytheism. It is perfect for our time of sustainability. We're green, environmentally friendly, plant-based, ethically sourced, and ready to be ruled by a green goddess. Let us proceed to the art and aesthetics of the goddess. We must make an arbitrary line somewhere, and I choose the time between 1983 and 1984 when Madonna burst on the scene like a virgin. The first thing that Madonna achieved was to separate mother and child. Madonna was no longer Madonna or My Lady. She was not mother with child or mother of God, pure, chaste. She was a global phenomenon who wore Catholic iconography while railing against patriarchy and societal conventions, Papa don't preach, or criticizing the hypocrisy of the church, like a prayer. She danced on stage with backup singers dressed like nuns and half-naked men half-dressed like priests. Album after album, hit single after hit single, she burned tradition like a deacon burns incense. Madonna has appeared as the goddesses Inanna, Ishtar, and Aphrodite. Ray of Light in the 1990s introduced her fans to Kabbalah and Hinduism with costumes to match. Her stage aesthetic, created nearly 45 years ago, is still the aesthetic. Leotard becomes lingerie. Spectacle, mimed sex. Madonna is the best-selling female artist of all time. A 2012 documentary about her was entitled Madonna, Goddess of Pop. I now rub out the chalk on my arbitrary line, and we will take a quick visit to the late 1960s into the mid-1970s and discover Fleetwood Mac and Stevie Nicks. Madonna stripped the goddess to nearly naked, but Stevie Nicks dressed the goddess like a witchy hippie. Bohemian, layering lace, fringe, flowing skirts, scarves, capes, and oversized hats. Nicks is adored by musicians from Harry Styles to Taylor Swift. Stevie sang at Taylor's recent wedding, to Adele, Miley Cyrus, and Sheryl Crow. In 1979, Stevie Nicks was dating Dawn Henley of the Eagles. Her IUD failed, and she became pregnant. She talks openly about her abortion. She did not want to take a child on tour or have it raised by a nanny. She said, "My life was my life, and my plan was my plan, and had been since I was in the fourth grade. If I had not had that abortion, I'm pretty sure there would have been no Fleetwood Mac." Do you remember Fleetwood Mac? Your children won't. Nick said that had she married Henley and the baby been a girl, she would have named her Sarah. Sarah became a hit single for her in 1979, but she has no regrets. Her plan was her plan. The baby Hitler thought experiment posits, If every fetus must be born because they could be great, does that mean we must also accept the risk of them being Hitler? The Global Life Campaign cites 1 billion total abortions worldwide since the practice was first legalized in the former Soviet Union in 1920. That's a lot of Sarahs for the risk of a few Hitlers. Bernard Nathanson presided over more than 61,000 abortions. Nathanson was born in New York City, Manhattan, to a Jewish family. According to Wiki, his father was an obstetrician gynecologist who exposed him early to the medical profession. He attended Hebrew school but lived as an atheist much of his life. Working as an OBGYN, he was one of the founders of the National Abortion Rights Action League to help make abortion legal. He worked with feminist Betty Friedan and others whose efforts succeeded with the Roe v. Wade decision of 1973, legalizing abortion in the U.S. and usurping states' rights. The development of ultrasound in the 1970s allowed him to observe a real-time abortion. This is where his story raises a few questions for me. Did it take an imaging technology for him to see the cessation of life? Did he not put it together with all the forceps crushing and suctioning? In any event, he wrote a book in the early 1980s entitled Aborting America, and often said that abortion is the most atrocious Holocaust in the history of the United States. Nathanson's 1984 documentary, which he wrote and directed, was The Silent Scream, featuring an ultrasound video of a midterm 12-week abortion. His next documentary was Eclipse of Reason, and it dealt with late-term abortion. In his 1996 autobiography, he wrote, "I am one of those who helped usher in this barbaric age." He developed what he called the vector theory of life, which states that from the moment of conception, there exists a self-directed force of life that, if not interrupted, will lead to the birth of a human baby. Also in 1996, Nathanson converted to Catholicism through the efforts of Father C. John McCloskey and psychiatrist Carl Stern, who was a Jewish convert to Catholicism. He said, "No religion matches the special role for forgiveness that is afforded by the Catholic Church." Lorena McKinnon is one of the artists who sparked a renewed interest in Celtic folk music in the 1970s. Her background included both Protestant and Catholic influences. McKinnon states that she neither attends any church nor belongs to any religion and is, quote, broadly spiritual. She rocked the goddess aesthetic with neo-pagan and witchy imagery, flowing black gowns, wild red hair. Her Celtic and world music connects us to pre-modern spirituality and nature. Her themes are divine communion and the interconnectedness of all life, themes that followed neatly on the heels of the 1992 Rio Summit, or the United Nations Conference on Environment and Development, UNCED, UNCED, or Earth Summit, as it was also called. To my knowledge, McKinnon has not spoken about women's reproductive rights, but has encouraged her listeners to vote so that their votes can help fight climate change. In this Alan Watt Redux from August 23, 2026, Alan talks at great length about conology and how we must participate in the con. People who live for pleasure and sensuality are the easiest to con. Sex, drugs, and rock and roll, culture creation, my generation. We are more than 50 years since Roe v. Wade, when what was once a shocking exception became the rule, your right, my body, my choice. Or as Billie Eilish screamed at her Texas audience at an Austin City Lights concert in October of 2021, my body, my effing choice. She said that she was so disgusted by Texas' new restrictive abortion laws, she almost canceled her performance in protest, but then decided that would be a punishment to the fans. On stage, she loudly criticized old men legislating women's bodies and urged the audience to tell politicians to shut the F up. In September of 2024, I made a Real History episode entitled Mashup. I started it with a Billie Eilish song entitled When the Party's Over, where she sang about a toxic relationship, drank some black goo that was supposed to look like blood. Tears of goo blood ran down her cheeks. The story I was highlighting in that talk was the fact that a life-ending contraption called a sarcopod had been used in Switzerland. I simply read the stories, spliced in a bit of Alan talking about euthanasia, and then I included the clip of Eilish at Austin City Lights encouraging her fans to scream along with her, "My body, my effing choice." I uploaded the video to the CTTM channels. After uploading the videos, I began checking all the sites to ensure it had gone smoothly. I saw that a handful of people had viewed Mashup on YouTube. I circled through once more to make sure I'd done the playlists, disabled the comments. There's just one of me, and I can't be a moderator too. And gotten it up on all 6 video platforms. This was before Substack. By the time I got back to YouTube, 10 minutes after the initial upload, my video had been pulled. The offense was, quote, promotion and or glorification of suicide, end quote. I used every one of my 500 words in the rebuttal to state that the sarcopod articles that I read from were sourced from YouTube. There is a link here. Note that those sarcopod videos are still up 2 years later. And that my commentary and that of Alan Watt were clearly against suicide in any form, state-sponsored or otherwise. My rebuttal was denied less than 20 minutes after I sent it. Further, I received a message from Google/YouTube inquiring about my mental health. Are you okay? Please seek help for suicidal thoughts. Here are some resources you might find helpful. That motivated me to back that video up on one of the main CTTM websites. Here is a link where Mashup can be found at cuttingthroughthematrix.net, and later I will upload it to Substack. My takeaway was that some people may talk about euthanasia and abortion, but evidently not me or Alan. What follows here is a link. Here is Billie Eilish rocking the Oscars red carpet with a goth goddess look. Trade secret alert. I start writing with a vague idea, a name or a title, and I research as I write, never the other way around. It makes the process more interesting since I have no idea where I'm going. It is not destination writing. It's a spontaneous road trip, a Sunday drive. The goddess Diana first came to mind, but I couldn't pin a sacrifice on her, so I moved on to Artemis. Just now, typing in, quote, Billie Eilish goddess, end quote, I was returned this result from the Joseph Campbell Foundation. Even the academics have made a connection, and the link is entitled Billie Eilish and the Transforming Artemis Archetype, and a quote from that article. She continues to embody the murky complexity and the unabashed certainty of the goddess archetype in a manner that somehow seemed reminiscent of Actaeon's fateful encounter with the bathing Artemis. Campbell describes Actaeon's gaze on Artemis as lustful instead of honoring, a completely improper reaction to such a deity. Seeing that look in his eye, Artemis simply splashed him with some water, and he was turned into a stag, and his own dogs then consumed him. Campbell, 113. Campbell goes on to say that the dogs represented Actaeon's lower appetites, which are what actually caused his demise. Billie Eilish continues to create and radiate goddess energy, firing creative arrows into the world, and instead of fighting every potential attack that arises, allowing those that would attempt to tarnish the golden properties of the goddess to be consumed by their own lesser selves. He was turned into a stag, and his own dogs then consumed him. hashtag Me Too. That was written in September of 2021 after the release of Happier Than Ever and a month before her Austin City Lights concert. I suspect the Joseph Campbell Foundation would have written approvingly about that performance, the goddess slaying it. And below is a picture of Billie Eilish looking ever the goddess. Today, after rendering and uploading the Redux to the video channels, I sent a message to G&G. I'm going to start writing now. A title came to mind on my morning walk. If the goddess is bloodthirsty, is she still worthy of worship? G&G had no idea what was on my mind or what my talk was about, but Graham had illustrated Alan's talk for the Redux. He sent me back a link to Florence and the Machine and a message. Here is a song to perhaps provide some inspiration on demon goddesses. If you haven't heard of her, then I'll fill you in later. Raised a Catholic and a big player in creating a chaotic modern matriarch. Her lyrics are dark, sung with the voice of an angel. I had heard of Florence Welch, possibly sampled a song way back when. I looked her up on Wikipedia. Perfect. Absolutely perfect for the ideas swimming in my head. Welch had a life-threatening ectopic pregnancy and miscarriage in August 2023 that required emergency surgery to remove a ruptured fallopian tube. She claims that it was this experience which moved her to become a vocal advocate for abortion rights, teaming up with Planned Parenthood in April of 2026 on her Everybody Scream tour to provide fans with reproductive health resources and information at concert venues. But was that miscarriage in 2023 the beginning of this phase of her, quote, activism? The video of her 2012 song, Spectrum, Say My Name, begins with light flowing from her crotch as she celebrates sexual diversity and tolerance of people's choices. In 2018, she tweeted in favor of the removal of the Eighth Amendment of the Constitution of Ireland. The removal passed and legalized abortion access within the country. Ireland, predominantly Catholic, one of the last pillars, bites the dust. Scrolling through the comments of the first song Graham sent me, Shake It Out, the word goddess kept appearing. She's a goddess. She has the voice of a goddess. This audience is so dull. Do they not understand they are in the presence of a goddess? And I'll make a note here to what I wrote for Sunday, is that I did not put in this essay, is that in part of my reading about her, I came across something where she said she'd been heavily influenced by Stevie Nicks and her whole aesthetic. And she just watched her for hours and hours, the way she dressed, the way she moved, the way she presented herself. I sent Everybody Scream to Graham. Watch it. He and Gabriella did. He wrote back. Pure evil. She is definitely possessed. Then later, he wrote, we think the flowers she has in her mouth are pansies, Steifmutterchen in German, and in Latin, viola tricolor, three colors, eh? Steifmutterchen translates into stepmother, most likely the evil one, and pansy is an effeminate male. The effeminate male is a caricature, but the neutered, silenced male is a reality that we have collectively created. For many years, we have participated in the con. Toxic masculinity, male privilege, white male privilege, hashtag me too. Graham wrote again, maybe the flower was a violet. In Greek, the violet is known as Ion. The Ionians were known for wanton dances and songs, and wanton gestures were called Ionic motions. In most of ancient Greece, abortion was generally legal and considered a household matter. Plato and Aristotle considered population control important for managing household size and civic stability. Ancient Vedic laws of India were concerned with preserving the seed of the three upper castes, and various punishments were given to women who aborted and priests who aided them. Ancient Assyrian law mandated death as the penalty for abortion. In World War II, Vichy France, there were strict pronatalist laws to help build up the population from its war losses. Marie-Louise Giraud was the last person executed by guillotine in France specifically for performing abortions. She was beheaded on July 30, 1943 under the Vichy regime. Throughout history, different people have had widely varying ideas about life, what a fetus was, when abortion was acceptable, which herbs were abortifacient, etc. The early Christian treatise called the Didache, which was written sometime before 100 AD, states, "Do not murder a child by abortion or kill a newborn infant. It's a cultural thing." In this redux, Alan Watts said, "People don't know. You think you're growing up in your own little bubble, again, in your generation. You look around to the left and the right, and there's all the bubbles of your generation going along with you, like a straight line, you see. Just ahead of you, you've got the older bubbles living in their generations, and everything that was normal to them is drifting off, and you are replacing it with your new normals, which you think you all do yourself. Somehow you think that you designed the clothing you're wearing. No, you didn't. Somehow you think you designed the hairstyles you're wearing. No, you didn't. Somehow you think that you designed the music that was promoted, but you know you didn't. Because you see, there are institutions above all these things. This is all part of the culture industry, and they decide what's going to be pushed and what isn't, you see." Florence Welch's Planned Parenthood sponsored tour was entitled "Everybody Scream." Watch this video and ask yourself, who gave me my culture? If you were raised in a culture you thought of or think of as Christian, ask yourself, who has decided to destroy that? Why? "Everybody Scream" is where it goes when there is no longer a union of the god and the goddess, when only the goddess matters, when men and women are turned against each other, when marriages fail at the rate of 1 in 2, when generations have grown up watching their favorite singers gyrate on a stage, the altar, nearly naked for 50 years, when people allow the, quote, termination of 73 million unborn babies every year. It ends with a celebration of demonic possession and sexualized rage. Now I'm going to replay Mashup. Maybe you didn't see it when I put it up a couple of years ago, and here it is now for you. This is Real History, and I am Melissa. Today is the 26th of September, 2024. And I had another cancellation this week, 2 weeks in a row. What does that mean? So I could not find a last-minute fill-in, and I had a little idea this week. I have been trying to catch up on a seriously massive backlog of emails. The little extra demands on my time this summer, I've just gotten so far behind, it was horrible for me. I could no longer cope with it. And, you know, there's somebody that sent me something some months ago, back in July, and then mentioned it again. And I'm like, oh no, I did not see that. I try to look at everything that comes in, even if I can't respond to it. But the truth is, I've missed some things because the inbox has gotten that full. So I feel really good about the progress that I've made. I'm not there yet, but I'm more caught up on emails than I've been in many months, since probably May. So this is good. But I didn't have anything in particular that I had lined up to talk about other than my guest. So I was looking at the different things that I had been watching and reading in preparation for this and that. People sent me some music videos. Actually, that came up on the Telegram book club site. There were a couple of interesting music videos just yesterday, I think, and some discussion about them. And then other things that had come into the inbox over the last really, actually, few months, including some letters. And so the idea that came to my mind this morning was mashup. So I am going to record a few things, a couple of articles that caught my attention, and I downloaded some video and audio of different things that I watched this week, and I'm going to make a little mashup. So this will be like an extended music video in a way, but there will be some of me reading some articles, and I am also going to put in a few cuts from Alan Watt. I always want to use the last name there, that fit the theme of what else I was looking at. So here is Mashup.
There's a whole new world waiting at the end of this, that you are not going to like, because you wouldn't listen. They said you just wouldn't listen to the sustainability agenda, and you wouldn't stop consuming. You wouldn't stop doing it. So they're going to do it all for you. It's as simple as that. So much for democracy. Now, I could go over many of the articles I did years ago. I could, where I go through the quotes by the leaders of the big foundations and the NGOs, these armies of climatologists or climate change advocates and so on, for sustainability. I could do one after the other, because there's countless of them, where they were open about it, where they offer up scary scenarios to get the people to listen, so terrify the public, you know. And it doesn't matter, again, if the climate science is all wrong, it's for a good cause, a good change for producing equity in the planet, things like that, coming from politicians, like it did in Canada. I could go through stacks of these ones by well-known people, but I won't, because I've done it all before years ago, and it bores me. It doesn't really matter, I think, how many times you tell people this anyway. It's an interesting thing. If they're not ready for something, you could teach them all day long with the evidence, including videos from the people giving these talks, where they admit lots of it could be down to opinion instead of real science. But it doesn't matter anyway, and it won't matter to them, because the next day when they hear the next bit of fear, they're back to square one again. It's a fact. That's how it works. The Great Reset, just as an example. I mentioned this before recently again, this one. And it says, to the global elite, the math is simple. Human overpopulation is causing climate change. So the solution to climate change is population control. Well, no, climate change is the excuse for population control, you see. Because they want to reduce, so they don't need you anymore. It says, today there is headline after headline in the mainstream media about how dangerous climate change is and about how the world as we know it is going to end if we don't take dramatic steps to fight global warming. But what they won't tell you in the mainstream media is what the final solution for the problem of climate change that the global elite will come up with actually is. You see, for the global elite, the math is simple. They believe that human overpopulation is causing climate change. No, that's what they say. I don't think they really believe it. And so the solution to climate change is population control. As bizarre as it sounds, that's why what they actually believe. The truth is that they are convinced that climate change is going to literally destroy the Earth. I really don't believe that personally. This is the article I'm reading here. I think they always know. I mean, they that climate changed before there were humans on the planet, folks, including, you know, very hot burning faces too.
Hey. I am so f***ing sick and tired of old men. Men in general, sorry. But old ones, especially. Shut the f*** up about our body! Oh my God! Shut the f*** up!
Welcome to Canada. The doctor will kill you now. This article is from September the 3rd, 2024, and it was originally published in the Wall Street Journal. Assisted suicide was sold as compassionate. In practice, it has turned out to be monstrous. That principle became less clear with the advent of physician-assisted suicide. Krauthammer was writing about Vaco versus Quill, in which the Supreme Court would hold unanimously that the Constitution doesn't create a right to that procedure. We are being asked to become a society where, when the tormented soul on the ledge asks for our help in granting him relief, we oblige him with a push, Krauthammer wrote, reflecting on the oral arguments. Lawrence Tribe, who argued the case for the plaintiff, suggested the slope wouldn't be so slippery. The procedure would be granted to the patient with end-stage heart failure, not the man on the ledge. At the same time, Mr. Tribe posited that people at the threshold, at the end of life, enjoy the liberty to decide how they die. Krauthammer spotted the argument's hole. Why couldn't the chronically ill, who face a lifetime of agony, or the healthy but bereft, avail themselves to the same right? Several states have since legalized physician-assisted suicide, and others are considering it. Americans who are skeptical of Krauthammer's warning might consider the experience of their northern neighbors. Canada has undergone a crash course in what the country calls medical assistance in dying, or MAID. The experiment began in 2015 when the Canadian Supreme Court ruled in Carter versus Canada that laws prohibiting physician-assisted dying interfere with the liberty and security of people with grievous and irremediable medical conditions. Parliament codified the decision the following year. Lawmakers thought they were imposing limits. We do not wish to promote premature death as a solution to all medical suffering, then Justice Minister Jody Wilson-Raybould said. The plaintiff's lead lawyer in Carter argued that in almost every case, doctors will want to help their patients live, not die. We know physicians will be reluctant gatekeepers. And I put in here that former Justice Minister made that statement in 2015. I think we all got a good look at what doctors will do as gatekeepers in the last nearly 5 years now. Article goes on, yet Krauthammer was right. The Superior Court of Quebec soon ruled that MAID was unconstitutional because it required that an applicant's death from a grievous and irremediable medical condition be reasonably foreseeable. Parliament amended its discriminatory regime in 2021, opening wider the door to facilitated death. The new law dropped safeguards, such as the minimum 10-day assessment period between request and provision. It also proposed mental illness as an eligible condition, the implementation of which the government has delayed until 2027. The message for everyone else remains the same. If you want to die, you needn't wait.
I could lie, say I like it like that, like it like that. I could lie, say I like it like that, like it like that.
Wednesday, September 25, 2024. Several arrested after American woman dies in first use of controversial suicide pod.
I'll only hurt you if you let me. Call me friend, but keep me closer. And I'll call you when the party's over. Quiet, and I'm coming home, and I'm on my
own. Zurich, Switzerland. Swiss police have arrested several people after a controversial, futuristic-looking capsule designed to allow its occupant to kill themselves was used for the first time, authorities said on Tuesday. Police in the northern canton of Schaffhausen, bordering Germany, said the so-called Sarko capsule had been deployed in a wood in the municipality of Merischhausen on Monday. Prosecutors in Schaffhausen have opened criminal proceedings against several people for inducing and aiding and abetting suicide, a police statement said, adding several people were detained without giving details about them or the deceased. A spokesperson for the group behind the capsule, The Last Resort, said the deceased was a 64-year-old American woman who had been suffering from a severely compromised immune system.
They say I like it like that, like it like that.
I wonder what compromised her immune system. Florian Willett, co-president of The Last Resort, was among the four detainees, along with a Dutch journalist and two Swiss people, the spokesperson said. Willett was the only other person present when the woman ended her life, the spokesperson said. In a statement issued by The Last Resort, Willett had described the death as peaceful, fast, and dignified. The Last Resort spokesperson said the woman had passed psychiatric evaluations prior to ending her life. Speeding along here. It's sleek and aerodynamic. The Sarko causes death when its occupant releases nitrogen gas inside, lowering the amount of oxygen to lethal levels. It is the brainchild of Philip Nitschke, an Australian physician famous for his work on assisted suicide since the 1990s. Switzerland has been a magnet for advocates of assisted suicide due to laws that make it legal there, and The Last Resort says its legal advice was that it could be deployed. The capsule has generated considerable media attention and discussion among authorities on whether they would allow it. Now, are you having a nightmare? Yes.
It's better sometimes.
A week or so ago, I read an article, and I'll look for it again. And it was about a couple in Britain that had decided to end their lives together in the Sarko pods as soon as it became possible for them to do so. I believe the plan was that they would travel to Switzerland and get in the pod and end their life. Now, the sad story was that the wife had been diagnosed with a form, an illness that could, I don't really think it was classic dementia, but it was something that might or most likely or probably would send her into cognitive decline at some point. The husband didn't want to go on without her. They had grown children and grandchildren, so this was their decision. In that article, I read that you get inside the pod and you are the one who controls the switch, so to speak. But once you have pushed the button or pulled the switch or however it works, that's it. There's no turning back. There is no escape clause, so to speak.
I could lie, say I like it like that, like it like that.
The New York Times said, on the 25th of September, in Switzerland, reported use of suicide capsule inflames debate. The Swiss police said they had detained several individuals after a 64-year-old American woman reportedly died by suicide using the controversial device. January 25, 2024. An Alabama inmate was executed with nitrogen gas. How does it work? Alabama inmate Kenneth Smith was put to death Thursday night, marking the nation's first known execution using nitrogen gas. Smith, who was sentenced to death for his role in a 1988 murder for hire, and already survived a botched execution attempt by lethal injection, was at the center of a heated debate over whether the execution method constitutes cruelty. Smith's lawyers made several 11th-hour attempts to prevent the execution. A federal appeals court on Wednesday and the U.S. Supreme Court on Wednesday and Thursday declined to halt it. Execution is a very specific kind of punishment, and no punishment, according to the U.S. Constitution, can be carried out in a cruel fashion, said Dr. Joel Zivot, an associate professor of anesthesiology and surgery at Emory University. And so the only real question is execution with nitrogen gas cruel? Officials started using lethal injection to kill people on death row about 40 years ago, and it's since become the most widely used execution method across the 27 states where capital punishment is legal. This is a total aside, but what happened with the overturn of Roe v. Wade and the federal abortion ruling of the 70s is that the federal government returns abortion to the state level. Around 2009, the drugs used to carry out lethal injections became harder to access, and states began turning to alternative drugs, a shift that has been tied to a surge of complications with the procedure. And that's what happened when Alabama first tried to execute Smith in November of 2022, and officials were unable to set an intravenous line before the execution warrant expired. How does it work? Smith likely would have been strapped down when this occurred. Nitrogen hypoxia would occur when a high concentration of the gas is inhaled, replacing oxygen in the body and causing death. The process essentially disables the respiratory system, a professor of surgery, Dr. Jonathan Groner, at The Ohio State University College of Medicine, said. Some officials say that a person would likely lose consciousness shortly into the procedure, making it more humane than other execution methods. They don't seem to know. The officials said likely. However, doctors have said that they could not pinpoint if or when a person will lose consciousness when exposed to high concentrations of nitrogen gas. On Thursday night, the execution process started at 7:53 p.m. Central Time, and a physician pronounced Smith dead at 8:25 p.m. Central Time. So that is 32 minutes. Nitrogen flowed for about 15 minutes during that time, and nothing out of the ordinary happened compared to what we were expecting, said Alabama Department of Corrections Commissioner John Hamm. According to witnesses from the news media, Smith appeared conscious for several minutes into the execution. For about 2 minutes following that, Kenneth Smith shook and writhed on a gurney, the media witnesses said in a joint report. That was followed by several minutes of deep breaths on the gurney. Following that, his breath slowed until it was no longer perceptible for media witnesses, the journalists said in their joint report. Asked whether the shaking and writhing was evidence that Smith suffered, Commissioner Ham, said, "It appeared that, one, Smith was holding his breath as long as he could. And then there's also information out there that he struggled against his restraints a little bit, but there's some involuntary movement and some agonal breathing." That's what they call the death rattle. So that was all expected and is in the side effects that we've seen or researched on nitrogen hypoxia. Agonal breathing, oh, they're going to tell us here, is usually described as a kind of gasping seen in people who are dying. Is it painful? This month, United Nations experts raised the alarm that Smith's execution could constitute torture. "We are concerned that nitrogen hypoxia would result in a painful and humiliating death. While doctors couldn't say definitely ahead of the execution what would happen to Smith, the possibilities left many concerned. If a mask is not secured tightly enough, oxygen could leak in, prolonging the death. When we put 100% non-rebreather face masks on our patients, they never get 100% because there's some leakage," Groner said before Smith's execution. "I feel pretty confident that he's not going to just take a deep breath and go to sleep. I think that's unlikely. Doctors say the lack of oxygen could lead to seizures, which have been observed in patients experiencing hypoxia. There's also a possibility that a person being executed with this method could vomit into the mask, which could cause choking or asphyxiation if inhaled into the lungs." The Department of Corrections altered Smith's last meal schedule after concerns were raised that he had been vomiting repeatedly. "Even if a person is fasting, they can still vomit water or stomach fluids," experts say. "If stomach acid is aspirated, it could burn the lungs. The stress, anxiety, or flat-out fear that a person might feel before execution shouldn't be ruled out. When we have an operation and someone's totally terrified, they actually respond differently to anesthetics. So a lot of the times, we'll give them a sedative before we even go into the operating room," he said before Smith's execution. "There's no talk anywhere of giving Smith anything to relax him. With most lethal injections, a person is first given an anesthetic to render them unconscious. Increased stress has been linked to heart attacks and other medical events."
So, because I wanted to punish this place for allowing that to happen here.
Officials say that what happened in the Alabama execution chamber Thursday night could set a precedent for other death row prisoners in the state and beyond. If the procedure did not kill Smith, complications could have left him injured or with serious brain damage, experts said before the execution. If they produce a corpse, then the states that want to do this will start doing it. So, what you have with the sarcopod is what they are using to execute prisoners.
Call me friend, but keep me closer.
Call me back. You are your own champion. In more ways than you perhaps realize. Because the act of not conforming to the demands of evil kind of has rewards in other ways altogether. Never mind helping you feel better, you've done the right thing for once. Eh? When the authorized professors come out and says, you know, people should just die a prescribed time off life. You've had so many years, just die. That was in Brave New World. You'd live a very healthy to the end, and the last week you'd be very ill and you'd die. Because they programmed it into you, you see. That's no coincidence. But why don't you die when you're 65 and leave your pension to the authorities? And they could make it the world more equal by using your money, by giving themselves bigger paychecks and things, you know, at the top. That's what you're living through right now. You're getting trained and programmed for a whole permanent existence from now on. And there are supposed to be exceptions for... And I read these articles years and years ago that have exceptions for those who are more important, people who serve the system well, who would be given life extension, you see, meaning for the elite and, you know, and all the prostitutes that they hire to manage us. And it also give permission to, for certain ones to actually breed, to have children, the better types, selective breeding, you see, and it'd be chosen for them, just, you know. And, but for the rest of you, you know, comment, oh, for goodness, you know, lots of sex as long as it's completely, you know, sterile. No offspring. Now, those in the Club of Rome, remember, who were tasked with, by the elite, to find a reason that they could give to the public, to give up their rights, to save something, the world, whatever, hit on the idea of global warming and famine and drought that would come out of it, and the like would fit the bill. Therefore, man would be the enemy, see? That's what they said themselves. And there was King as well. It was Professor Morris King. You know, King was one of the members, the high members, the head of the Club of Rome at one point too. And again, they're all humanists, eh? This religion of humanists. You should read it sometime, the Humanists Manifesto. And this is what Maurice King said, Professor, right? Global sustainability requires the deliberate quest of poverty. You're getting the point here. I'll say that again. Most folk really, it goes over their heads. It couldn't have been what I heard there. That's it. Global sustainability. Remember, this is very important to remember. Global sustainability requires the deliberate quest of poverty. Reduced resource consumption and set levels of mortality control. Set levels of mortality control. Okay. What do you think that means, mortality control? Length of lifespan, folks. This is all coming out again with the different ethics committees for the Rockefeller Foundation, now working with all those in the Johns Hopkins groups for the whole, and the great, the reset as well. They've churned out all their stuff. They've been working at it. They're lawyers, and they've decided what bioethics and what ethics will be for living and dying. You know, I've already put the articles out to you from their own websites. And it's all there now. These are your new ethicists. This is the new religious priestess. We've decided what's right and wrong and what's allowable. And it's allowable. We can euthanize you, etc. If you're just a useless eater, for goodness sake, then you shouldn't be eating. You're eating our resources. And we important people. We're intellectual people. We have the right, you see, to have more than you. You're eating our resources because... It's like Karl Marx said, each according to their needs and their means. Well, we're more important folk need more than you commoners down there, you see. So stop eating our resources. There you go. And that sums up. Or, you see, again, this is true. This is a real socialism. You don't realize it. The elite technocrats like socialism, where they can manage you all in a collectivist type society, where you don't have individual freedoms, you have collective freedoms. But they define what the freedoms are. Remember what the United Nations said 2 years ago? The individual is the enemy of world peace. Their definition, remember, of world peace is the Marxist definition, which is the end of all opposition. That's what they define as peace under communism. So you're living through the agenda here, and they've got all these different ethics boards set up, you see. They're already introducing, under. We're here to help folk, and it sounds, you know, kind of reasonable initially. You say, well, yeah, euthanasia started in Holland and Sweden and in Switzerland initially, where you could pay money for it, big money, but then the government of Holland allowed it, and now it's rampant. Now you can get killed for just getting a bit depressed as a teenager, and they'll happily put you out of your misery, you know. And then start to decide who should get put out, even if you don't consent to it, you see. Then Canada joined them, and the same thing. Now you can't trust the hospitals in Canada, folks. Medicine has lost, this is the saddest thing, you know, all credibility. All credibility and trust when they start deciding who's going to live and die. That's out the window. That's gone. Gone. If a whole profession signs on and accepts that, they should be ashamed of themselves and quit and leave their professions, because it's not a profession anymore. It's a total sellout to politics and an agenda. A horrible agenda, that. We're here to help you, eh? Ronald Reagan, the most terrifying things American citizens can hear is, we're from the government, we're here to help you. We should put up in neon lights, I think. So yeah, back to King here, Professor Morris King. Global sustainability requires the deliberate quest of poverty. What part of that do you not understand? This is for you, you see. Reduced resource consumption and set levels of mortality control. Okay, righto. I guess he was just daydreaming when he said it, eh? Maybe.
Many, maybe most legal systems are based on this idea, this belief in human rights. But human rights are just like heaven and like God. It's just a fictional story that we've invented and spread around. It may be a very nice story. It may be a very attractive story. We want to believe it. But it's just a story. It's not a reality. It is not a biological reality. Just as jellyfish and woodpeckers and ostriches have no rights, Homo sapiens have no rights also. Take a human, cut him open, look inside, you find their blood, and you find the heart and lungs and kidneys, but you don't find there any rights. The only place you find rights is in the fictional stories that humans have invented and spread around. And the same thing is also true in the political field. States and nations are also, like human rights, and like God, and like heaven, they too are just stories. A mountain is a reality. You can see it, you can touch it, you can even smell it. But Israel or the United States, they are just stories, very powerful stories, stories we might want to believe very much, but still they are just stories. You can't really see the United States. You cannot touch it. You cannot smell it.
Hey. I am so f***ing sick and tired of old men. Men in general. Sorry. But old ones, especially. Shut the f*** up about our body! Oh my God! Shut the f*** up! Like, and I have to be honest with you that when they made this shit a law, I almost didn't want to do this show. So, because I wanted to punish this f***ing place for allowing that to happen here. But then, I remembered that it's you guys that are the f***ing victims, and you deserve everything in the world. And we need to tell them to shut the f*** up. Do this. My body, my choice. Let's go.
Awesome.
Keep them up there.
Summer's in the... This is part of a letter that I received from someone. They've actually been writing to Alan for a long time, I think. And I was happy to catch up and read this. It was a nice letter overall, but this is something that they wrote. As for myself, circa 1970s, I began to sense that there was something wrong with, quote, the system, end quote. By the mid-1980s, everything that I had once believed to be true had been annihilated. All that defined me was gone. Lacking moral support, life was very much like walking on a floor of marbles. I was a mess for years, all the while stumbling across pieces of the truth and myth here and there. I discovered Alan in the late 90s, back when he was often a radio guest of the church lady. Forgot her name, sorry. And I'll just say here that the church lady was Jackie Petru. Those were the Sweet Liberty Talks. I just put one of those up a couple of weeks ago on the 15th of September. Alan was the first and only person to put the pieces together. He did it by referencing published and easily obtainable documents and tomes authorized by, quote, our betters, or, quote, the big boys, as he oft referred to them. No hoodoo, no voodoo, just facts. He also dove into the histories of the conspirators, their plans, and their organizations. No one was doing that. For me, the puzzle came together before my eyes, ears. But alas, one prediction stood out as unfathomable at the time: the hermaphroditic agenda. Well, Alan, you were correct. We're there. I'll put in here too, and I have said this before, but when I first encountered Alan's work, I wanted to read his books. I saw that he had them bound as a set and he had them individually available. And I ordered volume number 2 first. And then volume number 2 was A Glimpse into the Great Work. And then I ordered volume number 3, Esoteric Unveiled and the Meaning of Revelations in the High Masonic Tradition. And I read those first 2 volumes, and then eventually I ordered volume number 1, because all those years ago, I had no idea what the man could be on about with volume number 1, The Androgynous Hermaphroditic Agenda.
I will give you a quick rundown of the plot, and then I will show you the trailer, and then I'll show you some other things that you want to see, which really talk about what this New World Order agenda is about, which is a rebirth of a new species, a new race of humans. They've been talking about this right in front of our faces for decades now. Celebrities have been talking about it, talking about transformations. That's what they're discussing. And all this stuff you see right now with transgender and acceptance and tolerance, this is all part of that movement. Just nobody's connected the dots yet. So Uglies is a 2005 dystopian novel written by Scott Westerfield. It's set in a future post-scarcity world in which everyone is considered an ugly until they're turned pretty by extreme cosmetic surgery, which is what they show you is cosmetic surgery. It is really transhumanism, man and machine becoming one. It tells the story of a teenager who rebels against society's enforced conformity after her friends show her the downsides to becoming pretty. The book is set 300 years in the future, where the government provides everything, including plastic surgery operations. Everyone on their 16th birthday receives the pretty operation, transforming them into society's standard of beauty. After the operation, new pretties cross the river that divides the city, that leads a new life with no responsibilities or obligations. And you'll see that this is set up for the pretties to live in what looks like smart cities. And the people who rebel literally look like they're living off-grid. And of course, you could see, as you've seen on the screen here, the poster for the movie with the one-eye symbolism, the cover for the book with the one-eye symbolism. That is not a coincidence.
This is a little bit from a small book by James Tunney entitled Empire of Scientism: The Dispiriting Conspiracy and Inevitable Tyranny of Scientocracy. Page 92. In summary, science may be regarded as an ideology, and worse still, scientism definitely is an ideology with more inherent dangers. Scientism creates the illusion of certainty or truth that acts as a coherent force to unite materialists, scientists, entrepreneurs, capitalists, and communists in a dogma or ideology tending to idocracy. It looks like idiocracy. I don't know what that is. I-D-E-O-C-R-A-C-Y. I've not heard that word. Or Scientocracy. Scientocracy is an advanced form of technical control by technocrats based on establishing objectives deriving from scientism, scientific self-interest, and an associated class of entrepreneurs and managers. Scientocracy will be totalitarian in the highest degree. Scientism reflects an almost religious status of science, machine worship, tolerance of dictatorship, reliance on instrumental technical solutions and experts, over-reliance on metrics and quantification, and a refusal to adopt holistic analyses or solutions. Science, scientism, and technocrats promote a reductionist view of humanity and seek to deny very important elements such as rights, personhood, and human dignity itself. Stressing the exponential nature of technological growth promotes transhumanism as inevitable and suggests that Homo sapiens must yield to mastery by machines. This reflects the idea that we are machines, that society is a machine, and that we will become machines or slaves. This is an email that I received some time back, but only today had the opportunity, unfortunately, to respond to the person who wrote it. I'm probably on the younger side of your audience. I'm in my 20s. I don't find very many people to connect with who have similar views, but every once in a while I'm pleasantly surprised to find that there are people my age who are actively looking for answers, and that is super encouraging. My generation, much like every generation, was made in a test tube for one purpose or another. My generation was created for war and for self-destruction. We were created to be perfect slaves, ready to jump through any and every hoop. We were trained from school age to seek trends and to fit in no matter the cost. We were groomed to sell out and to switch sides at the drop of a hat, as Shakespeare said. All the world is a stage. But this indoctrination doesn't work on everyone, and most young people can feel something is very wrong. And somehow, the message of truth strikes a chord time and time again. It has for me and for some of my friends. Letters from younger listeners were a highlight for Alan because it gave him some optimism that there was hope for the future. And I feel the same way when I hear from young people or have the opportunity to speak with them. I'm encouraged. In part, it is by accepting scientists as the new priesthood that we find ourselves in the mess that we're in. So I generally hesitate to go to science for some kind of remedy. But I am reading an interesting book by Dr. Michael Nels, The Indoctrinated Brain. And he talks about the function of the hippocampus in creating memories and how it works. thinking system two or not thinking system one? This is the question. To consciously change one's behavior, one must first recognize that a change is necessary or might be beneficial. In addition, there must be a basic willingness to invest mental energy in even thinking about it. However, due to an often deficient hippocampal neurogenesis, more and more people are downright afraid of new things and therefore of behaving differently. Even if the necessity of a change is recognized as indispensable, for example, because the current behavior is obviously the cause of a disease process that could be stopped by changing the behavior, there is often a lack of willpower to implement this. Both thinking about a necessary change and the change itself until it becomes a routine require mental energy, which is often not available. Our executive and decision-making center, located in the frontal lobe of the brain, is responsible for such processes. But what kind of energy does it take to imagine a new way of life, to plan it, to make the decisions for an actual change, and to initiate its implementation? And he goes on about System 1 and System 2 thinking. System 1 is kind of automatic. He even refers to it at one point as the zombie place. This is business as usual. System 2 is where we can respond to challenges and generate and explore new alternative courses of action. One of his prescriptions so far in this book is a good diet and exercise as being very important for stimulating the part of the brain that is going to allow you to think about things deeply. So what he's really exploring here is, how did people's brains get to the state where indoctrination is so easily absorbed and not fought off in any way? I've said before that I love that talk that Alan gave in February on the 28th of 2007, Sing Your Song and Steal Some Time. The song, your life. The song is your life, and you have to live your life. And that is so important to do. So what is that that you do every day that connects you to being alive? I had a conversation with Prince the other day, and he got to talking about computers. Now, Prince is 75. He's an easygoing fellow, and he's gotten so much from listening to Alan. He said that his wisdom comes from years of listening to Alan. We were talking about how Alan used to quote that old preacher as saying, the devil couldn't get his plans done without the computer. And I mentioned that the other day. Prince was saying again in this conversation, if people would just throw out their devices, if they would just get off the computer and get off the internet, they couldn't do any of this if people would just get out of that. And I said, you're right. How many times do we hear Alan say, if I wasn't doing what I'm doing, I would toss the computer out the window? And I believe he would have. And what I said to Prince is, I know, I hear you. And yet I'm on there all the time because I feel that I have this little window left where I have to reach people who haven't yet had an opportunity to know what's happening and why. And Prince said, I know, the young people. And we talked a little bit more about how infrequently we encounter minds that are questioning, but they are out there. May I never get to meet the young man that wrote me that email. I seriously doubt that I will. But he's there. And frankly, that might have been a woman. I don't know who it was. But that young person in their 20s who is listening there are more like them. And there are also adults, people well into their life with grown children or even grandchildren who are just coming into an understanding, oh, hey, wait, whoa, something is very wrong. We all come, those of us who get there, to an awareness of reality at different points in our life. So, yeah, I'm still on the computer.
Thousands of years ago, they had their little folk sayings, as we always used to have little folk sayings, little ditties that would make sense like proverbs. And they used to say that when every a child is born, an individual child, your nature was your song. And so you'd have songs for so-and-so, and you had a Song of Solomon, even though that's esoteric and doesn't mean what you think it does. But you sang your song, that was you living your life, because the song was your life. In the old natural systems, each person would have their song. Some American Indians would have their particular individual song, like a theme tune. That was their way of communicating with whatever was out beyond them, which they sensed. A communication, so they communicated by their personal song. Everyone should have their song. It were a tragedy to watch people literally, mentally, and by the destruction of the soul, giving up that spark so early on in life and simply living to get old. There's no fire left in them. The song has gone out of them. I've been involved in music. I know what can be done to a song, but also I know what can be done to your own song of life. And then we go through the school system where they pick apart your brain and then reshape it into what's authorized. And if you can't conform, you're on Ritalin. I don't think anyone says it better than Melanie, who sings it with gusto.
Look what they done to my son, Ma. Look what they could do, hair frightened, it's turning out all wrong, Ma. Look what they done to my son. Look what they done to my brain, Ma. Look what they done to my brain. Well, they picked it like chicken bone, and I think that I'm half insane, Ma. Look what they done.